The Pentagon is a massive bureaucratic mess with hundreds of thousands of employees and a budget of hundreds of billions of dollars led by political appointees hovering over career civil servants. It can be a governmental nightmare. Laws are meant to keep the place running as honestly and as efficiently as possible. What then happens when a political appointee flouts those laws? Who does the law protect? I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Today, we're going to tell you the story of a Pentagon whistleblower. She's not a household name. Academics probably will not base their dissertations on her case. She hasn't been the subject of fawning exposés in the media. But she is a clear example of a person doing the right thing, bringing to light evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. Jackie Garrick grew up like many Americans who came from immigrant families, intensely patriotic and wanting to give something back to the country that had given them so much. In the 1980s, she did an internship at the Veterans Administration Medical Center in New York and developed an interest in post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, in veterans who had returned from service in Vietnam. In 1992, she joined the Army as a captain and a social worker, following the adage, if you want to work with veterans, be one. After leaving the military, she worked as the deputy director of healthcare at the American Legion and then went on to a position on the Veterans Disability Benefits Commission in the Department of Veterans Affairs. And after a few years on Capitol Hill, the Obama administration asked her to organize the Defense Suicide Prevention Office, which oversaw disability policies impacting wounded warriors, mental health care accessibility, suicide prevention, and diversity and inclusion. Jackie survived a period of great turmoil at the Pentagon, serving under 10 undersecretaries and 12 supervisors in only 8 years. In 2014, Jackie began working for a politically appointed supervisor who seemed to be hostile to her after she made legally protected disclosures regarding possible conflicts of interest and possible contract fraud. She was moved to another chain of command and soon after found that her performance ratings were being lowered and job openings were being closed to her. She filed whistleblower complaints with both the Office of the Special Counsel and with the Defense Department's Office of the Inspector General. For purely bureaucratic reasons, Jackie never received any satisfaction from her whistleblowing, and indeed, in the end, she lost her job and was deemed ineligible for federal retirement. It was only after a Freedom of Information Act request and an appeal beyond the U.S. Office of Personnel Management that she was finally able to retire. And once she did, she created the group Whistleblowers of America, where she provides peer support for other whistleblowers who have suffered retaliation after having identified harm to individuals or to the public. Jackie Garrick, welcome to the show. We're very happy to have you.
Thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here with you today.
Oh, thank you. The pleasure's ours. Let's start at the beginning of your story, Jackie. You were one of those unusual people who brought a great deal of experience when you began working at the Pentagon. You had already had experience at the Department of Veterans Affairs, for example, with the American Legion, which is a private organization, and also in Congress. You were then asked by the Obama administration to go to the Pentagon. What were you first asked to do there, and why was there such turmoil when you arrived?
Well, so the turmoil wasn't when I arrived. It was after I made my disclosures. I was very honored and excited to join the Obama administration. I actually stayed for the entire 8 years. But when I went over initially to work on Wounded Warrior issues, and then got moved around and ended up working on the Suicide Prevention Office, and then got moved again and again and again. And to some extent, you know, that's the life of the political appointee. But it was at the Defense Suicide Prevention Office that I made my disclosures, and that's when things really went sideways for me.
Mm-hmm. So you are at the Pentagon, and you finally feel comfortable. Tell us what it was that you saw that made you uncomfortable for that first time. What was the nature of your initial whistleblowing?
Yeah, so, you know, it doesn't take long to be at the Pentagon and realize how complex and complicated things can be over there.
Indeed.
And I was learning a lot about contracts and programs, and I had known a lot about how to manage and how budgets operated because of my experiences on the Hill, the difference between an authorization and appropriation. All of these nuances become important when you're working in these environments. And so when I was working in the suicide prevention office, and we had set that up after a congressionally chartered task force had said that the one thing the Department of Defense was lacking was the suicide prevention office. As you mentioned, I had a background in mental health. I'm myself a former Army officer. So I got asked to help set up this office. And with a lot of back and forth and what it should look like and how it should run, we were up and running. And we were doing some really good things. We had a number of contracts in place, and we were following federal acquisition regulations, the FAR, and how we set up those contracts. You know, the DoD is, there's no shortage of ethics training and compliance training, and there's a lot of this training. And I felt like I understood how these programs should run. So it was when another political appointee, she wasn't my direct supervisor, but she was at a lateral position above me, and she asked me about moving contract money that we had at one company to a contract with another company. We didn't have that company on contract at the DoD, so it would have meant having to move money over to the VA. And because she had been a vice president there, because her husband was a subcontractor to the prime, I thought, well, you should be recusing yourself. You shouldn't even be talking about this company.
Right.
And I thought, and I thought I was being a friend, you know, I was naive about all of this. And I thought, oh no, you shouldn't even say those things. And as the time went on and I was getting emails and this feeling that I was being influenced, I went to another political appointee who was above both of us, and I made a disclosure to him about what was going on. And he was kind of in tune that there was a lot of back and forth in all these emails. And so I made that disclosure. And it was really at that point in time that I thought, I did my job. I did what I was supposed to. I was done. And I thought it would all end. And then, of course, it didn't end. And the retaliation began a little bit different. Eventually, the person I had made my disclosures about ends up chairing an executive review panel. She's the only one who doesn't rate me at an above, at an acceptable standard, let's put it that way. And I eventually get moved out of the job as the Defense Suicide Prevention Office Director. And that's when I go to HR and I say to her, how is this all possible? What's going on? I don't understand. You know, by then I'm like more shocked and confused. And of course, all of this other stuff was unbeknownst to me at the time. And it was when I tell her the story about all of this, and she had told me, well, one person didn't rate you as high as the others. And I said, well, let me guess. And she told me, I cannot confirm or deny, but you're a whistleblower and you should file a PPP. And I didn't even know that PPP at the time stood for prohibited personnel practice. And so it was at her coaching that I went to the VAOIG, the OSC, the MSP. I just went to everybody because I wasn't really sure at the time what to do. And I was just kind of learning the ropes. There was no one to talk to, no one to ask questions. I felt very alone in trying to figure this out. I'm sure I made mistakes early on. There were lessons to be learned. But I do remember an OIG telling me, you know, be in for a penny, be in for a pound. He said to go to OSC. So I kind of followed the advice of these people in authority that I thought were helpful or there to help me.
Right.
And that wasn't always the best advice.
Right. Well, in government, we're all taught to go through the chain of command when we see evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality. You went through your chain of command, and then you ended up going to the Inspector General and to the Office of the General Counsel. You later said that was a mistake. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. So I think the mistakes that I made was, one, there was no guidance in any of this process. You really are hunting and pecking with a blindfold on, trying to figure out what's the right way to manage these things. You know, I'm a social worker by background, not an attorney. I didn't know if I needed to even hire an attorney at that point. So you're relying on reading websites, looking at like, what do they say evidence is, trying to figure this all out for yourself. And the mistake I made early on was not having the OIG investigate the case at the time. I've been to the DOD OIG probably three times asking for help, and three times they didn't open a case, or they referred me to somebody else. So the DOD OIG at the time never investigated anything that I complained about. They sent me to OSC, and it was at OSC where, you know, they tell you, we're attorneys, we're helping you, we're representing you. And it isn't until you get through some of that process that you realize, no, these are government attorneys. They're not really your attorneys representing you.
That's right.
Which is why so many whistleblowers end up needing an attorney even at the OSC process. I think that was an important nuance that in the beginning I didn't understand. So I eventually hired an attorney who helped me get through some of the OSC process, where I got my prima facie recognition as a whistleblower, and then this individual right to appeal letter to take my case to the MSPB. So there's nothing simple about any of this, and it's definitely, you learn lessons along the way. And it was one of the reasons that I set up Whistleblowers of America, because it made me realize nobody should be alone in this. And I was starting to be more public about looking for whistleblower information. And I went online, I was on social media, connected with somebody else who was at another federal agency. And she told me that she was in law enforcement, had a gun, and was contemplating suicide. And for me, that just triggered everything I knew about combat trauma, about suicide prevention, that we needed to do more and be more for each other, because no one is looking out for the whistleblower in any of these kinds of cases.
We are speaking with U.S. Defense Department whistleblower Jackie Garrick about her experience at the Pentagon during the Obama administration. We're going to ask her and you to stay with us as we take a short commercial break. We'll be right back.
Волынь – это особая территория на Украине, территория, все время находящаяся так или иначе под контролем противоборствующих сил. К 1939 году поляки составляли примерно 15-20% населения Волыни.
Когда был атак на Союз Советский, в том же атаку również брали уже два батальона украинских националистов.
Морды массовые, подчас которых нищено цале все Волынские, распочались в лютом 1943 года.
Они верили в то, что таким образом они движутся к созданию украинского государства, независимого, моноэтничного, такого, какое они хотели видеть.
Українських націоналістів, тобто власне Донцов опублікував, там же не завагався доконати жодної зброї на своїм противнику, якщо того вичерпав добру Україну. І це той же огромна позбусою життєвісті.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Pentagon whistleblower Jackie Garrick about her experiences in the Department of Defense. Jackie, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you for having me here.
Jackie, I would love to know the results of your whistleblowing. It's easy to get lost in the bureaucracy of whistleblowing and the obstacles that we face when making our revelations. The important thing is that you made a complaint about waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality. What ended up happening with it? Were changes made? Was it finally corrected?
So it took 5 years for my case to run the wickets. And in 2020, after getting the FOIA, not what we got on discovery, but what I got on FOIA, and by then I was pro se, I was representing myself, I was able to read to the judge these emails and things that I had gotten on FOIA that I hadn't gotten on discovery. And that for me was cathartic just in of itself, was to read those things to him. And then to win my case in 2020 was probably the most surprised person in all of this was me, because it was that feeling that he truly believed me, mm-hmm. that in his decision he saw that the animus and the retaliation were really there. And he awarded me my retirement benefits that I had applied for. So that was great. He owed me 3 years, or the government owed me 3 years of back pay. And so I took that money and I've reinvested it into building Whistleblowers of America. So on that part, it has been great. After I was removed from the Defense Suicide Prevention Office, I went back and I said, well, where's the accountability for what happened to the program? And if you go on the website, I don't know if it's still up there, I haven't checked in a while, but the DHRA, the Defense Human Resource Activity, oversees the budget for the Suicide Prevention Office. And somewhere between 2016 and 2017, that office is reduced by $20 million. So it goes from having, and I'm rough estimating here, a budget of about $25 million that I was executing on to now about $5 million. Mm. And then in subsequent years, the Defense Department says, oh, we have increased the budget, because it went from like $5 million to $8 million to $9 million to $8 million. And the budget has sort of fluxed around there. Since I was removed, it's also gone through a series of directors. The one that was there after me was moved over to the VA and then resigned from government. The following, there was a couple of interim directors. The last director that was there left, and I don't know if there's now another permanent. So there's been at least four or five directors over that office, with a budget that has gone down. And, you know, the suicide numbers among the active duty guard and reserve, I think, speak for themselves. The only time we ever saw a reduction in suicides was when we were looking at the 2014 and we were specifically targeting programs towards the guard and reserves. We saw a decrease, a little eking downward trends that we were hopeful that we would see again in 2015. But of course, it was in February of 2015 that I was removed. And from what is available, public documents, it looks like the programs and the contracts were then canceled in 2015 by that summer, by August. Most of my work that I had incepted was canceled, and the programs and the things were going into a new direction. There was another contract after that called Be There, and I've had several whistleblowers call me about that program basically being a sham, that it didn't take the numbers. I supposed to take the calls. The people who I've talked to said, you know, they were given embroidered shirts with their names on it, but then they weren't allowed to go out into the public and do any outreach or spread awareness about the program. So I think there's been other concerns. I know that the last time I saw a hearing and there was testimony about the DOD sort of shrugging its shoulders and not seeming to know why the numbers were going up. And that was the last permanent director who I said has since gone. But it's been those frustrating moments for me to see the DOD call suicide the new normal. There are ways and trends and initiatives that you can take that could reduce suicide that are evidence-based, some of the peer support stuff we were doing. There are ways to make suicide prevention more effective than I feel like the DOD has done in recent years. And, you know, that makes me personally sad. It adds to what I feel like is been my frustration over all of this, because I feel like we were in a good place. And I hate to see where we are now with the suicide numbers at the DOD and at the VA. Neither of them have been outstanding in terms of what they've been able to prevent.
And you were under real time constraints when you blew the whistle because you were a political appointee. That meant that your job literally ended at the moment that the Obama administration left office, even if you had to keep up the fight for your retirement benefits into the Trump administration. Did that time constraint help or hurt your ability to blow the whistle?
So I had really hoped that the Office of Special Counsel would have been more helpful in allowing me to stay on in a career or non-career position and there are different authorities they could have used to do that while my case continued. I honestly thought from 2015 to 2017 that we wouldn't be dragging this on. And the one issue that gave me authority to continue my case was because what the DOD had done was they converted the position from a political to a career position, which then gave me whistleblower rights because I had applied and was trying to remain in the position as a career position. So my political appointee status really didn't matter for the case, but my employment ended when the Obama administration ended, and nobody after that was willing, of course, to be helpful to help me move this case or continue this case as a federal employee.
Mm-hmm. You went on to found the organization Whistleblowers of America, as you've said, to provide peer support to whistleblowers in need of it. Honestly, as I said a moment ago, I can't think of anything that whistleblowers need more, except maybe legal representation. Tell us about founding the group, pulling together the resources, and the work that you've done. What kinds of whistleblowers have reached out for help?
So every kind of whistleblower has reached out for help. You know, when I started this, I really honestly didn't know what I was getting myself into. I thought we needed to have these kinds of conversations amongst ourselves so we can help each other solve problems, make decisions, and be resilient. I quickly learned that it's a surprise that you need an attorney for federal employees, that you need to know how to hire an attorney, that you need to know how to work with the media. I mean, thank goodness I had some media training while I was at the Pentagon. So it's explaining simple things like what does it mean to be on background? What is off the record? How do you know what kind of an attorney? I mean, I have people who say, yeah, I talked to an attorney. I'm like, okay, how versed is your attorney in whistleblower laws? And they're like, I don't know, he's the guy who handled my divorce. And it just makes me want to cringe and shake my head. So the idea that we need each other, we need to help each other understand these things, I think is important. And then to be able to talk about, you know, how is your family handling this? How are you managing this? who's helping you? Who's supporting you? How are you developing your evidence? Do you know what a level of evidence means? I get people who will tell me, oh, I have evidence, and then they'll send me emails that they wrote. I'm like, no, that's not really evidence. That's your opinion, mm-hmm. and it could be good to help build your case, mm-hmm. but that's not what this means. And so I'm constantly trying to help people understand the nature of their case, how to work with the media if need be, how to work with Congress if need be, how to work with investigators, the OIG, the GAO, like who can you go to for help? And who else can we build a team to help you care about this? And whistleblowing is a tough subject. We don't have sick children and cute puppies mm-hmm. that are part of our, well, we do when we have people who are blowing the whistle, because I've worked with all kinds of whistleblowers. But when we talk about the whistleblower, not necessarily the case, it's very hard to get the right resources to support this mission. Like I said, I've invested a lot of my own money.
Right.
We definitely can use more support. www.whistleblowersofamerica.org has a donate button on it. So anybody who wants to help this cause is invited to join us. But otherwise, this is a complex set of issues and very, very difficult to get people to understand the true nature of these cases.
It is indeed. Well, I would like to thank our guest, Jackie Garrick, for joining us today and for sharing her experience. And I'd like to thank our viewers for being with us. Martin Luther King once said that life's most persistent question was, what are you doing for others? The Bengali poet Rabindranath Tagore answered when he said, I slept and dreamt that life was joy. I awoke and saw that life was service. I acted and behold, service was joy. Thanks again for joining us. You've been watching The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Until next time.